and welcome to the Commentator's Curse. My name's Ian Danter. I'm lucky enough to have commentated on football matches on local and national radio for over 20 years now. And in every press box I attend, I bump into some incredible people they do exactly the same job as me, only entirely different. And they've had very different routes as to how they've got there and very different methods that they've utilised in order to stay there in the job that they love, in this weird, weird commentary world we inhabit. And that's what this show is all about, just lifting the lid a little bit on what it's like to have this job where you go around the country watching 22 men kick a bag of wind. Two guests with me today. There is an archive of episodes that you can find where you located this podcast. Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker was episode one. John Champion and Nigel Pearson, episode two. Kevin Hatchard and Robin Cowan was episode three. And the most recent was Jim Proudfoot and Nick Barnes for you to delve into and enjoy. But let me welcome our two guests on this edition of The Commentator's Curse. First, a man who, I never get to hear him on a Saturday afternoon because typically when I'm doing a 3 o'clock TalkSport 2 commentary from the Premier League, he's doing a 3 o'clock Premier League commentary of a different game on BBC Radio 5 Live. So we are, in a sense, direct opponents, but as you'll soon find, hands across the airwaves. We have a lot of love for one another, and we did spend some great times together when I was England correspondent, and he was working, of course, for England as well. Ian Dennis from BBC Radio 5 Live is with us. Hello, Denno.
Dan's good to see you.
Always good to be with you, Denno. And my other guest is, he's now a TalkSport colleague of mine, in actual fact, since just over a year ago when he returned to his first love of radio, where he cut his teeth firstly in Nottingham and then quite famously in Radio City as the 70s became the 80s. Then, of course, an extraordinary career on television with ITV, BBC, and then back to ITV again. Clive Tilsley's with us on the Commentator's Curse. Hello, Clive.
Hello, yes, still alive.
there's your catchphrase, Clive, still alive.
There used to be a fantastic a quiz feature which Simon Mayo did called Dead or Alive. Do you remember it?
Dude.
And I love it. We still play it. It's clearly not correct enough for 2021. But it is what I am becoming. Clive, is he still? No, I think he's still alive.
Dead or alive?
Alive, alive-o.
That's it. I remember the catchphrase. God, blimey. We do love radio, don't we? Now, radio is, of course, Clive, if I come to you first, it is where you cut your teeth. And I heard the news this morning that Chris Hughton has been relieved of his duties at Nottingham Forest, so another upheaval there at the City Ground. That was the city where you'd studied, wanting to be a sports commentator, and you found your way in to work at Forest when Brian Clough had not long arrived. Is that right?
It is, yeah. And I think it's still true in 2021 that the first break is the biggest break, particularly in a competitive business such as ours. And right place, right time often trumps any amount of qualifications or entries on CVs. And I was graduating from an industrial economics and politics course at the University of Nottingham as Radio Trent came on air. And of course, we're hiring a complete station staff, including three T-boys, two T-boys and a T-girl, as it turned out. And I just managed to get a foot in the door there, and they haven't been able to shut me out since. So Cloughy was my first manager a fairly terrifying but inspiring man to be around for those first 18 months. Martin O'Neill was my first friend in football. I was the same age as the players. It was an era when you could go and have a beer with them afterwards. And, I do look fondly back on those 18 months and the first sort of 7 or 8 years that I spent subsequently on Merseyside with the players, similarly with the players of Everton and Liverpool. And I'm sure the same case with you two, that a lot of the friends that you made, the guys who were the same age as you back then, are still among my best friends in football.
I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah, it's the people you encounter who are good to you when you're on the way up, as it were, that kind of stick with you as the years go by. I would be interested to learn whether Cluffy ever called you the S-house word, because that seems to be a term he used for pretty much every reporter, newspaper writer and commentator he encountered. Did you ever...
Yeah, I graduated from son to young man. That was my elevation over the 18 months. He was drinking, and that's not me telling tales. That is just a fact. The only match in his life that he couldn't win, and it was sad to see from a distance. I sometimes ask myself whether I, in a small way, could have done something about it, but I didn't have that kind of association with him, really. I was very much in awe of him. He was a bit of a bully, if I'm being brutally honest, but then that was kind of the way in the 70s and 80s around dressing room corridors. But when he was in the room, there was nobody else in the room. And when he granted me an interview, which I guess he did every couple of weeks, not only was that a wonderful learning experience for me as a young broadcast journalist, but it got me exposure, because that interview was national news. And so as a local radio reporter who was able to get to Cluffy, then every other local radio station, I don't know if you remember, we had a network called IRN, which was the equivalent of what is now ITN, and you pooled your interviews. So it was the interviews that Brian Clough granted me that brought me to the attention of the next employer.
Denno, with you, obviously there's a real Yorkshire theme developing with this podcast, with all the people that I spoke to already, like Guy Mowbray and John Champion and Nigel Pearson. You're a Yorkshire lad, and you did, I think I remember rightly, you had a brief spell at BBC Radio York, like as a Saturday lad.
Yeah.
But your actual break as a broadcaster came with, was it William Hill or was it Team Talk?
Well, it was at William Hill, but then that morphed into Team Talk. It was part of the 0898 services in the day when, can you believe, people used to phone up and fork out, what, 45p a minute to listen to some buffoon telling them what they probably already knew. Or if they waited the next day, they could read it in the papers. But that was the way it was then. But Guy Mowbray worked there as well. But then I went to Radio Leeds. And, you know, you talk about a Yorkshire theme. Radio Leeds has spawned a number of excellent commentators who I've been fortunate to follow in the footpaths of: John Champion, Peter Drury, Miles Harrison. And Clive's talking about a big break. When I was at Radio York in 1988, it was, as work experience, I was very fortunate to meet Miles Harrison briefly, but he had followed Derm Tanner, who was the sports editor who got me on board. And little did I realise that Derm was to have such an influential role in my career that he once then got me a board, an interview, that's what they called it at the BBC, just for experience. And then he recommended me to the managing editor at Radio Newcastle. And he said, you've got to take a chance on this young man. And therefore, I was able to get the sports editor's job at Radio Newcastle in 96. And very similar to Clive, in those days, the Beeb weren't bothered about sending anybody to the northeast of England. So all my interviews with Kevin Keegan and Alan Shearer were being sent down to Network. And then all of a sudden, through that, my name was known at Radio 5. And two or three years later, I had an attachment down there.
Did you always want to be a commentator? Because Clive was talking about, you know, having that ambition whilst he was at university at Nottingham. What about you? Was that always in the works?
Yeah, I always knew I could do the job, but it was just getting that opportunity. And I used to sit at the top of the stairs and play with an action man and commentate with an action man, or commentate when we were playing Subutio. So, but, you know, I've always wanted to do it, but it was just getting that opportunity to do it. And I was very fortunate in the end to be given an opportunity.
That's very familiar. I think I did the Subutio thing too. Although, strangely enough, we didn't have a Subutio in our house. It was our cousin who lived around the corner who had Subutio. So I used to drive him insane, the poor kid, with me.
Well, controversially, we used to play it on the carpet, because when it bounced on the table, it was a little bit like the synthetic surface at Boundary Park or Loftus Road back in the day. It gave you too much of a bounce, whereas the carpet, you got more of a natural roll. It wasn't good for your knees or the patches on your jeans, but still it worked.
Patches on jeans, this is what they want. now, Clive, people like myself and Denno, we were able to take our inspirations from that first wave of television and radio commentators that came through in the 70s, and we eventually got our chance in the 90s, in my case, and Denno the same. But with yourself, Clyde, you were in that second wave. When you think of the first wave of Kenneth Wolstenholme and David Coleman and Hugh Johns, and then into the 70s, you know, it was that era where the likes of yourself got your opportunity. First on radio, of course, because you spent a long time at Radio City, didn't you?
Yeah, best part of a decade, really. You know, what a time to be on Merseyside. I arrived in 1977, the spring of 77. Liverpool won their first European Cup, Champions League, within a few weeks of my arrival. The two events were not linked in any way. But during that period, obviously, I covered massive football success, not only at Anfield, but also at Goodison Park. But more than that, you're part of a newsroom in local radio at that time. Funnily enough, I attended a funeral just a couple of weeks ago and bumped into my old news editor for the first time in years and years. And we had a joke about Anne Finally, you know, how a sports story would only ever appear in a news bulletin as an Anne Finally. You know, even in a city like Liverpool, where football is just running through the veins of everybody there, it's difficult to convince anybody in the newsroom that it actually mattered to the people more than this political story that they were leading the bulletin with. But political stories on Merseyside, I mean, I covered a Thatcher general election victory and a local election victory for Militant Tendency on Merseyside within a year of each other. And, you know, I was there during there were riots in the Toxteth area of Merseyside at the same time as there were riots in Brixton and parts of Birmingham and so on during that period. There was never a dull moment on Merseyside. And I think it did. I do think we are or should be journalists. I think we should think editorially about commentary in the same way that a really good news reporter thinks about a report from a war zone or something. I think the same principles apply in terms of recognizing the audience, investigating the story, researching the story, speaking to both sides, finding some balance, hopefully before your brain clicks into gear and you actually speak. It's very difficult to do that during a live commentary. But those years on Merseyside were very, very valuable for sharpening my editorial instincts.
Speaking to Jim Proudfoot on the previous episode of this podcast, he was saying to me when he looks at the landscape now, he finds it, he can't get his head around the fact that Radio City no longer covers Liverpool and Everton. He'll never get his head around that decision. I presume you're of exactly the same mindset.
Yeah, I mean, I think our business changes by the day, and I think it's exciting. I hope that I'm, even though I'm now a veteran or whatever you want to call me, I have four children in the mid to late 20s. And so I think I actually have, probably in the last 10 years, I've got a wider perspective of how media is created and consumed than I had when they were young. I mean, I think when you're a parent of young children, your life tends to revolve around their kind of daily needs and around the school run and actually, I think I've got in terms of my job, I think I've got a stronger relationship. I've got more input from them and from their friends now. So I accept a lot of the changes in media, and that just happens to be one of them. The local newspaper, as we knew it, is nothing like a stronger voice in communities. Communities are more diverse. The world has shrunk. The country has shrunk. I don't think people think in terms of their immediate locality in the way that used to. When you see an ad on television news bulletin from a region, it does seem, I don't know, I feel it seems a little twee and not irrelevant, but slightly detached from the national issues which are affecting everybody and getting discussed every day. The national radio is very strong at the moment. You know, that I mean, TalkSport and Five Live are two really good representatives for our game at the moment, and it's just changed. Of course, you know, the big Champions League games that we've commentated on this week are being seen by audiences of a million or so on television instead of 8 or 9 or 10 million. That's not, you know, that's not me being bitter about it. It's just how everything has changed, and we've got to change and move with all of that.
Back in the 90s, Denno, you were, as you mentioned, at BBC Radio Newcastle, speaking to Kevin Keegan and Alan Shearer. But I was speaking again on the last episode about the perceived war, certainly the boardrooms, between BBC and ILR. You had a lot of competition for audience up in Newcastle with, you know, Metro Radio trying to take your audience away. There were all sorts of scraps over Coventry rights and exclusivity that you had to deal with.
Well, when I went to Radio Newcastle, because of the deal and the strength of Metro at the time, with Mick Lowes was the commentator, who is, you know, many ways the voice of Newcastle United. He transformed the way that, when he was at Radio Newcastle, how you look back at the North East now and the hotbed of football that it is and what have you. And Clive talks about the And Finally section. Before Mick arrived in the North East, football coverage and the sports coverage just was very minimal. And Mick transformed all of that. And then as a result, went on to Metro. So he's had a massive impact on how radio is viewed in the North East. And he was very much the imposing figure of the North East. And Radio Newcastle only had second half commentary, which was really, really weird that you had to wait in half time. And the story might already have been over. Newcastle could have been either 3 goals down or 3 goals to the good. And yet, although we were rivals, Mick took me under my wing, and all of my disciplines in terms of arriving earlier to ground, the way that my commentator notes are set out, we all do it differently, but mine are very similar to Mick's. The way that you interact with managers, the way that you ask managers questions, so many of my disciplines, both on and off mic, I think, have been influenced by Mick. He's a real character, and he's had a huge influence on my career in that respect. And he took me under his wing, and therefore we used to travel to the games together. So yes, we were rival commentators on rival stations, but we've been friends for many, many years. And we used to travel with Mick Martin and John Anderson as a quartet. And the laughs that we used to have away from home, you know, abroad as well, they really were great times.
Fantastic. Well, and that just reinforces the point I've been trying to make on this podcast, that there isn't that, you know, thing where a Five Live journalist spots a talk sport journalist in the press box and starts lobbing bread rolls at him from a distance and, you know, wants to maim and kill. There is a great deal of camaraderie in the press box. Clive, who was your mentor? There's Denno talking about Mick Lowes. Who took you under his or her wing?
A man by the name of Reg Guttridge taught me 95% of what I know about communication, let alone commentary. I didn't ask him to. He forced himself upon me. It was tough love. I had similar friendships and often with rivals to Ian's, with lovely Mick Lowes, still in touch with Mick. But in terms of a mentor, in terms of somebody who made it his business to try to teach me his business, Reg was remarkable. And, you know, even to the point, I remember the first Network England game that I commentated on live. You'll probably remember in 1999, there was a playoff between Scotland and England over two legs to qualify for the European finals. And BBC had the first leg at Hampden, which England won quite comfortably, and then went into the second leg, which was live on ITV. It was a big, big night for me. And I did okay, but the following morning, I got the phone call, and Reg didn't think I'd done okay, and he told me. But it was tough love. There was cruel to be kind about it. And during the first lockdown last year, I poured a lot of these thoughts onto the page, and it was very therapeutic to write 90,000 words about our business, really, and the people that I've met. It's not an autobiography. It's more a commentary on the life of a commentator, and there's a whole chapter dedicated to Reg, and the lessons that he taught me, and the students that have had to listen to me in lecture theatres up and down the universities of the UK have had to listen to the Reg Gutteridge book of on communication. All of the lessons that he taught me, I hopefully took on board, but I certainly tried to pass on because they're as relevant today as they were back then.
For those that aren't aware, Reg Gutteridge was he was a commentary voice as well on...
He was a journalist too, Ian. I mean, that's how he started. So yeah. He's a newspaper man, really, yeah.
But boxing was where he became known as a voice, and he was as much of an importance to boxing commentary as Harry Carpenter was for the BBC. And certainly when ITV had their fair share of boxing rights, I think of the Nigel Benn, Michael Watson era, Chris Eubank, Reg was definitely front and centre there. But you also branched out into other sports too, Clive. It's not just been about football. There's been a bit of rugby league and a bit of cricket in there too, hasn't there?
A little bit of cricket. I think possibly two Roses matches for Granada TV. Funny enough, Martin Tyler was the lead commentator who took over for me in the sessions. And I had the great Fred Truman alongside me for some of those sessions. But I like cricket. I don't know cricket. I don't know. I know football, but I certainly know football better than cricket. But interesting exercises were my dalliance with rugby league, which lasted again for 3-4 years because Granada bought some live rights to rugby league. And the sport was very welcoming in terms of accepting me as somebody who, hands up, didn't know the game as well as I needed to know it in order to broadcast it, welcomed me in. I tell a story in the book about asking Doug Lawton, who was the coach of Widnes, who were the best team in the country, arguably the world, at the club team and the world at the time, if I could, you know, come to a game and sort of listen to him or speak to him before or after. And his version of that was sitting me down next to him, actually on the bench during the game, giving me a fag, and then just starting to talk to me rather than the team during the course. I mean, that kind of acceptance was really, really instructive, and so I so appreciated. And I went through a crash course in basketball of a similar kind for the Olympics in Atlanta when I was working at the BBC. So I think it is possible, and you know, we've been surrounded by some really good broadcasters. Barry Davis did a lot of sports very capably. I think Andrew Cotter does to this day. I think he's becoming one of the real doyens of our business now. Very, very impressed by his work. But football was a funny one because the public know the game pretty well too, our public. And I think you need to be a football specialist to have the credibility to hold the attention of the mass football audience that we talk to.
I go along with that. I mean, I branch out and do a little bit of darts for Talk Sport, and I have done some cricket, but it is mostly about football. Have you branched out at all, Denno, during your time away from football?
Yeah, once did Wimbledon in 2007. Never been asked back, so that tells you everything about my future in tennis. I used to do cricket, and I once did Greyhound commentaries as well. So I can read Greyhound form. And although when we used to do the 089 at numbers with Rapid Greyhound Line or whatever it was called, the 153 at Hall Green, I mean, the race typically would last about 38 seconds. But there were some occasions and some tracks where you didn't actually have the pitches. So you were reliant on the Greyhound on-course commentator to say that they've broken. It's traps 3, 4, 6, and 5. So you're writing these down. And then so there's a delay in the commentary. So a normal Greyhound commentary would last about 40-odd seconds. But when you've done all that, as we're on the bend, the race is over like minutes ago. You probably listened to the result, and it's cost you about 90p for over 2 minutes when the race never lasts that long. But yeah, can do Greyhounds. And I did cricket as well. And a couple of funny stories in the 90s when we were covering the West Indies, I think it was 95. If we mentioned Cornhill Insurance when we used to do the all-day commentary, the hostesses would top you up with wine as they made their way around the commentary box. So every time we'd see them, we'd go on, yes, this is the third test, sponsored by Cornhill Insurance. By the end of the day, we'd taken on quite a bit of wine, And then there was another occasion when I was working at Radio 5 and I was doing a T20 game. It was Durham, Warwickshire at the Riverside, and there was a little annex to the side of the commentary box. And they used to alternate the commentators. So you'd take it, a 20-minute spell would be 10 minutes with one summariser and 10 minutes with another. And I was in the annex just watching with Graham Swann, and Graham Swann just somehow mentioned, have you ever seen the final episode of Rainbow that never went to air? And you can watch it on YouTube, and it's just full of innuendo.
Yeah.
And I was in absolute tears. Anyway, he's disappeared, gone to do his commentary stint, and 10 minutes later I've joined him. And I said, well, here we are at the Riverside. I said, this game really is intriguingly set now. Durham required to win. What do you think, Graham? He said, well, you can't be that captivated by it. You were watching Rainbow a few minutes ago. And he completely put me away on air. And I didn't know where to go. He completely took me out of the knees. I'm not too sure I did cricket after that. I had to come to think of it.
As you would say, Denner, was a yellow card.
That was a red. That was a red to Graham Swann.
Yeah.
Now, I think they are completely different disciplines. And I think it's an interesting area, particularly on television, because in a way, cricket and golf, which is one of my passions, are covered by co-commentators only, really. I think you almost have to have played the game to a decent level to be able to contribute, certainly on television as a cricket or a golf commentator. There isn't that need for, if you like, the journalist, broadcaster, to call the names. That's not required in cricket and golf. There isn't that kind of running commentary feel. I know that TalkSport are running some golf commentaries at the moment. I have to confess, I haven't listened to them. I must do that one night on the motorway. And certainly they are long nights on the motorway.
Yeah.
Coming back, I'll be fascinated to hear. I've heard a bit of Gigi Salmon's commentaries on tennis, and it's rather like a horse racing commentator. Even with all my eons and decades of experience, I cannot imagine calling a horse race, and I cannot imagine calling a tennis match. They seem to have skills that are way, way beyond me in order to provide a picture of something rather like this greyhound race that Denno is doing, which happens in no time at all. It's like the 100 metres final at the Olympics. What the heck do you say in 10 seconds, less than 10 seconds? So people marvel occasionally at what we do. But don't worry, we marvel at what other people do too.
I agree with that. Because if you think about the greyhounds, the jackets are still the same from traps 1 to 6. The horse racing, and sometimes there's a real charge in the final furlong. How they're able to distinguish certain silks from another in a nanosecond. I marvel at the racing commentators.
I've asked Rupert Bell that very question, who is TalkSport's racing commentator. Maybe Cornelius at Five Live, who spent a long time as their racing commentator, would say the same. But Rupert just said, you just need a bloody good pair of binoculars. And that was pretty much his sum total of experience that he brings to that role. A bloody good pair of binoculars helps you out a long way down the line. But you're right, Clive. I wouldn't want to go near a horse racing commentary for all the tea in China, just fraught with danger. It's a sport I don't pretend to understand in the first instance anyway.
Yeah, and when I'm asked inevitably who's your favourite commentator, I think it's partly a political, diplomatic answer. I never name a football commentator. The best co-commentator, which again I'm often asked, going back to the question you asked about rugby league, was a guy called Brian Smith, who was the coach of Hull FC, an Australian. And the reason that he was the best co-commentator I've ever worked with was he knew the sport. I didn't know the inner workings of the sport. I didn't know the hows and whys of why tries were scored and matches were won. And he recognised that, and we worked as a team. He supported me. He helped me through and covered for my lack of understanding of the sport. And he was a very generous colleague in that respect. So I think the more football you watch, even though I'd never played the game to any level at all, I think I probably watched enough football now and listened to enough football people, more importantly, to have a feel for it and understanding of which way a game is going. If I was introduced to a different sport, I just wouldn't have that.
Moving back to you, Denno, you went to work for National BBC 5 Live in the early 2000s. And there's one thing I haven't really delved into so far on this show, and it's the two commentator format that, of course, the BBC have used for many, many years. And you've done you do single commentaries a lot now. You were at Anfield last night, but the two commentator format is a really intriguing one, one that you were that you walked into. It wasn't something that you advocated or you wanted or didn't want. It's just the way the BBC have always done it.
Yeah, and they still do for the big games. I'll be honest with you, when I went to Radio 5, I was used to doing commentaries. I'd worked with Norman Hunter and Peter Lorimer, and I'd done 90-minute commentaries, and you've got certain lines that you think, oh, I'll keep that stat back for the second half or what have you. And yet you're then going into a scenario where you're doing the invariably, because I was the junior member of whoever I was working with, Ron Jones, Mike Ingham, I would do the first half of the first half and the first 22 and a bit minutes of the second half. I've got to say, I actually quite enjoyed that, because when I went to Radio 5, it was a wake-up call to think, okay, this is where I am. This is where I need to go. I need to raise my standards to match those who I'm working with. And therefore, when I'm sat alongside either a Mike, a Ron, a John Murray, you're able then to realise who and how they operate and the standards that have been set. So I actually quite enjoyed it at that time. And I remember my first game, it was a trial game, in fact, at Celtic, before I'd actually joined Five Live. And Ian Brown, credit to him, because obviously the egos and the seniority, oh no, you go first, you're the junior member, that's part and parcel. And Ian Brown actually said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you 22 minutes grace, settle in, take your time, get to know the players. You know, my knowledge of Scottish football at that stage was not great. And it was he did me a real turn that day. I'll always be indebted to Ian Brown for the courtesy that he afforded me that day, because that 22 minutes grace, I mean, even then, when I came on, my shirt was dripped with sweat, my hands were just sticky. I was a bag of nerves. And that was with 22 minutes grace. So Ian Brown did me a huge turn that day.
Was there a kind of a point, therefore, you mentioned that sort of senior-junior dynamic. Was there a point where you felt you'd actually, gone to that next level and found that senior position? Or was it just almost like the, boiled frog thing where you suddenly realise, oh, wait a minute, I'm higher up than I realised I was?
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things that eventually Mike would say, I'll go first today. And you go, all right, thank you. And it's just, it became, I mean, I don't mind even now when I work with John doing the England games, I know John's the correspondent. So I'll say to John, I'll just fit in with you. You know, if you want to go first, you go first. I'll go first. I honestly don't mind. I'm just pleased to be doing the job that I'm doing. The other thing I found actually was, because I used to work with Norman and Peter, they used to cover my mistakes. There was that chemistry, that understanding, and if you did make an error, they'd cover for you. And yet all of a sudden, one week I might be working with Jimmy Armfield, then Mark Lawrenson, then Graham Taylor, these different huge personalities in the game, huge names, and I felt I had to prove myself each and every week, because I was working with somebody new. And that was the thing I actually found quite daunting when I first joined.
Interesting. And Clive, of course, I don't know who you worked with when you were at Radio City sort of covering Liverpool, Everton between 70s and 80s, but you've developed a number of on-air relationships as a television commentator. There's Denno talking about this myriad, and I have a myriad of pundits that I work with, but you got used to working with Ron Atkinson, for example, as when Champions League became the big thing for ITV in the 90s, and that's probably the relationship for which you're best known.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting subject. Certainly, I think it's of interest for us to discuss between ourselves and possibly, for listeners and viewers to eavesdrop on us, the relationship with the co-commentator. I've been very, very fortunate that most of the people that I've worked with, nearly all of them, I think I would struggle to name anybody that I worked regularly with who I didn't form a really strong personal relationship with. And whilst we have the best job in the world, we do a lot of traveling during a tournament. A lot of that traveling is done at 5 a.m. in the morning or close to midnight. Your flights get delayed. Cars get stuck in traffic. And very often you're in the back seat with the guy that you know, you're going to be spending the match, the whole of the match with too. So the ones that are particularly good tourists, as we say, you know, guys that are still got a sense of humour at an early breakfast, the morning after a late night match, are as valuable to you as friends as they are as co-commentators. Where I think we have to give some thought is to how that relationship evidences itself on air. I think it is, if it's natural, I've been working with Ali McCoist quite a bit in the last year, and I think people have tuned into the fact that we get on, and there is a natural kind of, banter is a sort of an archaic word now, but there is something going on there between us, which other people can log on to and tune into and get a feeling of the warmth that we feel for each other. And I think that's very, very healthy. Where I think you've got to be careful is when you carry that relationship over and beyond. So you start to exclude your audience. So you're actually becoming a bit too chummy, a bit too sort of, you know, nicknames and where we had dinner last. I'm not a great lover of airing that kind of chumminess, really. I always say you're a couple of steps away from Statler Waldorf's balcony if you're not careful, you know. It all, and actually, the audience have not tuned in for you. They've tuned in for the game. You just happen to be covering the game. You're not the stars of this show. And so therefore, what you did last night, what you're going to do today, where you are tomorrow, is actually of no importance to me as a care worker or a bus driver or whatever I do for a job. So I think we've got to strike a balance where the natural friendship comes out, because I think that's good. But I think we also have to be a little bit careful. And I think there are examples out there at the moment of double acts who start to bore me, if I'm truthful. Where they're playing golf together next.
Never played golf in my life, so I know I'm excluded from that one. We talked about tourists. That's a really interesting point, actually, Clive, about good tourists. Deno, I got to know you really well when we were all out in Brazil for the 2014 World Cup. I've been installed as Talk Sports England correspondent. And I was pretty much on my own, ostensibly. We were part of a press pack that the company BAC had all flew out en masse, first to Miami for the warm-up games and then to Rio. But I was pretty much on my own. I was ostracized from the rest of the Talk Sport crew who were in a different part of Copacabana. So I actually gravitated towards yourself, Deno, and Alistair Yeomans and the chief, Mike Ingham. And I still never thanked you properly for how brilliant you guys were with me. It's another example of hands across the airways, because there was that great quote that Charlie Watts, the late great Charlie Watts, said about the Rolling Stones. He was asked about 25 years of being in the Stones, what was it like? And he said, 5 years of playing, 20 years of hanging around. And that's what being an England correspondent feels like a lot of the time, doesn't it? There's an awful lot of hanging around, waiting for a press conference to start or for a player to be brought to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think every journalist has spent many a time hanging around and waiting for a player. But with England, you know, all of a sudden the press conference will start at one. Now it's been put back to half one. Now it's at 2 o'clock. You know, the flight's been delayed, what have you. But you've got to just sometimes make your own fun. And I think when you go abroad as well, there are those who sometimes just cocoon themselves into the room. And if you're away on a major tournament for a World Cup and you're doing that for 6 weeks, it'll feel like a prison sentence. I went to Ghana and the African Nations in 2008, and rather than I was away for a month, and rather than count every day, I made every day count. And I think when you go away, that is an adage that I very much live by. You know, you cherish every moment. We've got one of the best jobs in the world. We get to travel to places where you'd never normally travel, and you get to travel with people who just sometimes you can spend time in the company of footballers who previously just been watching on the TV, and it's a dream job. And sometimes there might be occasions where you just sit and listen and just soak it all up. I mean, now I've met Jose Mourinho socially, didn't say a word to him, but for that half an hour, I just was pinching myself. You know, I remember one of my first trips to Madeira Maritimo Leeds United. I was sat in the company of Ron Jones, who used to play part-time, I think, for Aberystwyth, David Fairclough, Norman Hunter and Bobby Gould. And I just sat there and listened and let them talk football. And when people are talking football, as my wife will tell you, I'm in my element. And I wasn't the one talking, I was just listening. But I feel very, very privileged at times.
There is a cost that comes with this, though, gents, and that is the social cost, in the sense, and I've spoken about this before, that your social life in many ways is gone. And it's actually accentuated when you have to spend 5 or 6 weeks away at a tournament, like you just mentioned there, Denner, African Cup of Nations, World Cup, European Championships. We miss births, we miss sometimes, you know, the reset, we miss deaths, we miss anniversaries, we miss, you know, get-togethers. There's a lot of sacrifices that have to be made. I don't want to overplay it, but nevertheless, we do miss out on a lot for the joy that we receive in the one hand from doing this incredible job that we do.
I think, you know, Dennis just mentioned some extraordinary names who've become part of broadcast organisations for periods in their careers, maybe between managerial jobs. I think they find a communion not unlike the dressing room when they come in, you know, to our groups. And I think it's a buzz for them. You know, some of the most surprising broadcast success of recent years, Roy Keane is a really good example. Gary Neville actually was quite difficult as an interviewee during his playing days. But when you do spend time with them, as I've been fortunate enough to do with both men and many others of a similar kind of A-list caliber as football people, they open up. They feel comfortable within that team, because it is very much a team game, live broadcasting. The man or woman who is the sound engineer is as important, maybe more important to the broadcast than we are. And so you build relationships with them too. You know, you come to get trusting relationships with them, which build into friendships. But I think these guys, particularly when they are out of the dressing room, which is such a big part of their lives, they find a little bit of that repartee, a little bit of that sense of belonging, that little bit of teamwork. And I think if you do your job well and do it professionally, and they see that and they see the preparation you do, I think you grow respect from them, which probably you didn't have when you were that awkward bugger who was standing at the other end of the microphone, you know, asking them difficult questions. So quite a few of the friendships that I've built in recent years have come with people that I knew in their playing days, but didn't have any kind of relationship with them. And the team thing is, how many times we've been asked the difference between radio and TV? The difference, the biggest difference, and I say this to the students, is you're just not as important on television. It's a visual medium, and you've got to get your thick, vain head around that. You don't matter as much as the radio commentator does. And I think the radio commentator, to a degree, just go and plug in and go. And I think it comes from the heart, a lot of it. And as a television commentator, you've got to use your head a little bit more in terms of concentrating on your part in the bigger production. And so in a way, there's more of a sense of team in a television outside broadcast than there is. I'm not talking about the social side, but I'm talking about actually when you're performing, because you've got the director, who's the most important man or woman on the outside broadcast, the person who's calling the cameras. You've got that voice in your ear all of the time, and you're following them. In radio, you just kind of go. In many ways, coming back to radio and talk sport, it's fun. It comes more from the heart than the head. And actually, you can put down the microphone, and Denno's done some great commentaries in recent years where you just feel physically exhausted at the end of it. And you kind of look across, and there's Alan Shearer or whoever, and he's physically exhausted just having watched this match and gone through it with you.
Well, there you go. The Liverpool-Barcelona comeback game with you and Alan is a prime example of that, Denno. You must have lost weight doing that commentary.
Yeah, but it's funny, and I don't know what Clive thinks. I remember there used to be a guy covering Yorkshire cricket years ago called Tom Schofield. Wonderful man. Gruff Yorkshire voice. And he said to me, he says, the day that you do the perfect commentary is the day that you retire. And there's not been one commentary that I've done and I've thought, oh, that was good. I always come away thinking I should have done that. And indeed, I did that night. But I said to Alan ahead of the game, I said, look, we need to make this entertaining, because if Barcelona score second half, it might become a little bit drab. So we never really thought what was going to happen did happen. And people think it's a cliche, but I said, if it is going to happen, it's going to happen here at Anfield, because I've been there before, Borussia Dortmund in 2016. You know, there's been some wonderful nights at Anfield, and it was incredible. And what's bizarre about it is that even now, Alan will send me a text and he'll go, it's starting up again. There'll be another love-in, another wave of a love-in on social media. And again, just very, very fortunate to be there. But it's a night that I know that Alan thinks the same, that we'll never, ever forget.
And Solskjaer has won it, broke the cardinal rule of commentary. I waved the winner across the line before the winner had got to the line. If Bayern Munich had gone down the other end and equalised, and it had gone to extra time and penalties, and Bayern had won Bayern would have won the shootout, because Germans won shootouts back then. You know, there would have been an effigy hanging from the roof of the Arndale Centre of me, and I would have been blamed for the defeat to this day. So there you go. I look back on sort of 3 minutes of commentary, which are probably, people of a certain age certainly would associate with me more than any other 3 minutes. But actually, when you listen back to it, I broke the cardinal rule of commentary.
Those are three very important minutes for commentary students to listen to, because I know you don't script anything, Clive, but there were certain epithets in that. Name on the...
No, I don't script anything. It's not cheating. I always, people sort of say, do you think of these lines beforehand? Well, yeah, of course you do. And you might not write them down, but sometimes actually during a game, and Denno referred, I commentated on that Liverpool-Dortmund game that he's referring to, when Lovren scored in the very last minute. And if you're commentating on a game like that, and Liverpool get a free kick at the top end with a minute to go, what you should be doing, certainly you're entitled to do, is ask yourself, what the feck am I going to say if this goes in? Because it deserves more than, oh, amazing, incredible, fantastic. It deserves more than that. And that's, that if there's such a thing as a responsibility on us to play our small part in people's memories of that moment, it is to come up with some words which belong with that moment. Now, if your editorial mind is ticking over the day before, the week before, the minute before, the second before that happens, asking yourself, what am I going to say if this turns around? That's just doing your job. And I do have a kind of a, if I'm doing a big final where I'm going to be commentating on the trophy presentation as well as the final whistle, and the final whistle is maybe going to require 60 seconds rather than 6 seconds, then I will write down on a piece of paper the night before, as part of my prep, Manchester United win, Bayern Munich win. Not the whatever those flowery words were that I came up, but the significance of that victory. So, what it will mean in factual terms. What are the facts that will be most relevant, so that I'm not having to find those at any, they're there, they're ready to go. And then around those facts, once the moment has happened, once the achievement is there and it is part of history, that's when hopefully you can attach those editorial phrases that tomorrow morning's headline, Reg used to say to me, what's tomorrow morning's headline going to be? In an era when the back page mattered more than it did today. Absolutely. And so if you can come up with tomorrow morning's tabloid headline within seconds of it happening, I think you've done your job.
Clive, do you agree what Uncle Tom told me about the perfect commentary? Do you think the
absolutely
perfect...
yeah, never happy. I do watch back and listen back to most of what I do, or I'd certainly try to listen to parts of it. For instance, if I did a TalkSport commentary last Saturday, and I recorded it on Sky Plus, and then I'll dot about. I'll have 20 minutes where I sit down, and then I'll wind forward 20 minutes and start it again and come in as a listener who hasn't heard the match to that point. How soon do I give the scoreline? Which, nothing more frustrating than listening to a radio company. What the bloody score? Tell us. You can't tell people too many times. There's a guy I remember used to do a breakfast show on the first radio station I worked in Nottingham. And all the complaints he used to get about not giving the time. This is, in an era when we didn't all have mobile phones and we all kind of knew the time. And he said, I give it every 30 seconds, but I still get complaints that you don't give the time off. You cannot give the score often enough. And I don't think you need to say, for those of you who have just come in, I think you can recap on the game quite regularly during the game without having to make any apology. That's another Reg Guttridge rule. You know, don't apologize. If a piece of information is worth giving, give it. Don't, of course. He used to nail me for saying, of course, because he said, you're splitting your audience in two. Of course, he scored here for his club team in a cup final here at Wembley a month ago. What you're saying is, listen, I know most of you know this, but I'm now talking to these numbskulls over here who don't follow football like we. Don't do that. Don't divide your audience in two. Be inclusive. Don't talk down to people. Commentate to your grandma. That was another thing. Don't commentate to the England manager. Commentate to your grandma. She's one viewer just like the England manager. You used to go on about that maths class that we've all sat in where you're on the back row and you've got half an hour here and you haven't understood a bloody word of this, but you're not going to put your hand up. Explain the away goals rule. It's okay. If you get stick on Twitter for explaining the obvious, that's not a problem. If you get stick on Twitter for not explaining something, that is a problem.
One of the facets of your work, Denno, is the maelstrom that is transfer deadline day. I know you have a lot of contact in the game and your phone on transfer. I pity you. I really feel sorry for you on transfer deadline day because you've got so much information coming in, coming out. It's all flying at all angles. It's one hell of a day, that, for you.
Yeah, but I think that's a little bit of a myth about the phones. And I know that there was a certain television station that used to pride themselves, well, I've got three phones, they're going to phone any time. It's a load of baloney. Because on a transfer deadline day, you phone your contacts first thing in the morning, scattergun approach. If you strike lucky, you might get somebody who'll call you back. There was one time I called somebody at Hull City and he said, I'm actually with the manager now. He said, I'll put you on to him. And I started speaking to Steve Bruce, who told me what the business was going to be for the day. But the days of, I think, of getting a genuine exclusive now are becoming even harder because of the nature of the clubs, their own sort of like in-house channels and websites now that keep that back. I mean, the one that I was very fortunate was Andy Carroll going to Liverpool from Newcastle. I got a phone call just saying, Newcastle have turned down a bid of 30 million. And I went, wow. And I knew straight away from where I got the information that I could run with it. And then the guy phoned me back within 5 minutes and said, don't worry, they're going to come back in again. And on the basis of that, I was able to deduce that Torres was then going to go to Chelsea. So the domino effect that you often see on deadline day, it fell in my lap that particular day. And there's a couple of chief executives who, if I don't phone them on transfer deadline day, you know, they feel very upset. So it's become a tradition that we will talk, and invariably they will talk about other clubs rather than what's actually happening at their own club, because everybody knows each other's business. I don't enjoy it. I think it's full of hype, and I'm not into all that. I just want to just do my job without all the hype that goes with it.
At least you're not envisioned at a training ground with some supporter sticking some strange object into your left ear, as happened to a colleague of ours on television.
Yeah, I have done the odd television, and I went into the studio, and the lady said, do you want some makeup? And I went, no, I'll be all right. And she looked at my head and she went, you need makeup.
there's a section in the book, funny enough, where I've talked about the exclusives that I managed to get, and I've stumbled over all of them. I wasn't looking for any of them. There's a lovely story, which again belongs in its era, where I travelled back from a cup final down at Wembley with the official Liverpool party on their train, and the wives had obviously travelled with the players, and my wife had travelled with the entire group too. And as happened, I'm afraid, back then, we all had a few glasses on the train on the way back before we got into our cars and drove home. As we staggered to the multi-storey car park at Lime Street, my wife said, I said, have you had a good time? And I said, I haven't seen you on the whole journey. She says, yeah. It's just, I really like Danielle. It's a shame about them, her and Graham going to live in Italy. And I said, what? She said, yeah, oh yeah, Graham Souness, they're going to go, he's leaving Liverpool, they're going to Italy. And it was literally, I had to go and see Peter Robinson, who was the kind of chief executive at Liverpool on the Monument. I said, look, I'm sorry, I've staggered across this. And he thought, as he did, for about 10 seconds before he said anything, he says, I'll make sure you get the story first, but let's keep this between us. And sure enough, he did the deal with me, really. A couple of weeks later, he phoned me and said, we're now ready to release the information that Souness is traveling to Sampdoria. You can have it first.
Well, that's all about the relationships, isn't it, that you build up with people. It's that trust. I remember Peter Ridsdale, I gave him a call when he was the chairman at Leeds, and he went, you're about to make the same mistake that the Yorkshire Evening Post did. I said, what was that? He said, you haven't asked me what's happening. I said, what's happening? He said, we've just signed Robbie Keane. You know, but that again, it's that trust and relationship and the confidence that you build with people over the years.
Exactly. It's a two-way thing. And some of our listeners who know you, Clive, from all the work you've done on television as a commentator won't necessarily be aware that you were a sports editor. You had that job of, you know, collating that information and deciding what was worthy of broadcast and what wasn't.
Yeah, on a daily basis at a local radio station, obviously your first responsibility is to the next minute. You know, we live in a 24-hour news environment, which has actually changed the whole coverage of news. You know, stories never stand still. The follow-up to the story starts within seconds of the original story being broken. But it is kind of, I'm not a foot in the door reporter. I'm no Gabriel Clark, you know, but I did, I think, three stints as the cup final hotel reporter for network television, which was a huge deal when the FA Cup final was such a big deal. And, you know, Des Lynam would open the programme at lunchtime, and the first thing that the BBC do would go to the two team hotels before the players left the hotel. And you were supposed to have a stab at the team news. And I got Everton when they had the cup final against Manchester United. And Joe Royal was, and you know, just the one most wonderful people to be around was the manager. And I checked into the hotel. I was there. I stayed with them at West Park Lodge, I think it's called, up in Hertfordshire. But because we were good friends and because he knew the nature of my job, which was to get his team, he was going to do everything in his power to make damn sure I didn't get his team. And funny enough, Neville Southall eventually spilled the beans about 30 seconds before I went on air. And I couched it in terms where I believe that and I think that. And Everton beat Manchester United, Paul Rideout's goal. The afternoon progressed, big shot victory. I'm now down in the old tunnel at Wembley, waiting for Joe Royal's nod to take the cameras into the dressing room to film in there. And he came down that corridor it's a tunnel, alongside the coaches, big grin on his face, huge man. And I inevitably kind of held my hands up. My pal had won the FA Cup. And I disappeared into this massive bear hug. And all I could smell was underneath his armpit and everything. And then I heard this voice in my ear, and excuse the French, who told you my f***ing team? This is like 4 hours later, 5 hours later, you won the cup, who cares?
We are running short of time already on this chat. So there's a couple of other things I want to allude to before we wrap up. Deno, I mentioned our time in Brazil. There was one evening I'd love to recount to our listeners where it was the night after England had lost to Uruguay in Sao Paulo. And because Costa Rica and Italy had, I think, drawn then, we knew we were going home. Mm. We knew England, or at least I knew I was going home. You were probably staying on a little longer.
I'm worried where you're going to go with this, but go on.
Well, the BAC people asked us whether we would...
They
threw a caprina part. Is that how you pronounce it? The Brazilian
caprina. I used to drink caiproscas.
They organised for all the press pack, the England press hounds, a little caprina party at the hotel, this Lemmy hotel where most of us were staying. And yourself and Alistair Yeomans came along. I'm not sure the chief turned up for that evening, but anyway, you might remember. I think it was Brian, who was the head of BAC, approached me and said, Dance, I've heard you do a couple of impressions on the coach. Would you mind, you know, doing a little routine, entertaining the troops for 10 minutes? I said, well, all right, but I'll need a straight man. And you graciously offered yourself up as my straight man. Problem was, the idea was you set him up, I'll knock him down. but our set-up knockdown abilities were somewhat on the wane after a couple of Caprinas. And I don't know how we muddled through the routine that we did for 15 minutes, but we got laughs, but I didn't think we'd done too well.
Well, I felt a bit of a fraud that night because we were down the coast in Sao Conrado with the England team. So we joined you in your hotel there, myself and Alistair. And I said to Alistair, I said, don't worry. I said, I won't be having many tonight. We've got an early flight the next morning. I think he had to help me out of the hotel. And also, I think we were paid a token amount of money from BAC, but I actually didn't do a great deal. I just had to say, I was the prompt for you. You were the star attraction.
But the funny thing was, we got laps, and I thought they're just being nice, you know, that, you know, because they're under the influence of the same amount of Caprinas that we were under the influence of Swan. But when we finished, you know, there's people like Henry Winter and John Richardson and some lovely people there, and out of the crowd, walking towards you and I, comes Charlie Sale, the Daily Mail's sports hatchet man, walking straight for me with a stony face, making a beeline straight for me. And he walks up and you may remember this, Dan, but he wagged his finger in my face and said, do you know what you've just done? I said, no, Charlie, I don't. I'm terrified at this point. You've just made a room of gnarled old hacks laugh their heads off. That's a decent effort. Shook my hand and walked off like Glenn Miller into the mist, never to be seen again.
Well, it was a somber mood at the time. I mean, that's when England go out of a tournament. It's always, I remember Bloemfontein, Chris Waddle, phoning me up and saying, right, you're coming out for a drink. I went, oh, Chris, you're coming out, otherwise I'm going to fall out with you. And we went out and put the world to rights. And it was quite somber because obviously it was disappointed that England had gone out after two games. But there was a real camaraderie with England. I mean, obviously I've been very fortunate to, you know, we talked before about rivals. When I first joined England, Clive was doing it for the television and Clive was very, very helpful towards me, even though that it was ITV, BBC, radio and television, always looked out for me. And I think that camaraderie does exist when you're following England with the media pack.
Yeah, because you are in a completely different language, different culture, and you do tend to gravitate towards, you know, people you understand or feel that you have an affinity with when you're on the other side of the world.
I call it the Coleman Balls Communion. We're all in it together. You know, we're all a second away from the next cock-up. So, we're on the same cell block.
Can I ask you as well, Clive, about something, a little facet to your career, and I don't know how mind-numbing it is or how rewarding it is, but you've been utilised by EA Sports to do FIFA. Which, of course, is the computer game of choice for millions of young boys and girls and men and women. But I imagine the recording sessions for those must be interminably long.
Yeah, in a way, it's as hard as I ever worked. I used to write it too. I inherited the FIFA microphone from Motti. And I inherited it at a time when my kids were starting to play FIFA. The parents at the school that they went to, the kind of junior school, used to chastise me. I had to listen to you all yesterday, you know, coming out of his bedroom for whatever, 4 or 5 hours. But I think I probably appreciated how important it was to my career to do the job well. FIFA was made in Vancouver to a large degree by Canadians. And there were one or two gold miners and goaltenders in the script that I inherited, which I think it was very, very important that I changed. I'll tell you a lovely story about the impact of FIFA. My wife and I went on a fantastic holiday to the Middle East. Oh, when would it be? Probably now 8, 9 years ago. And one of the places we visited in Jordan was a kind of a desert scene where you spend the night under the stars, under canvas. There's a proper loo and everything. I don't really do that kind of. I'm a bit of a glamper, really. But as we drove out through the desert, this is fantastic, kind of almost like a moonscape. In fact, it has been used, that area, Wadi Rum, it's called, as a set for sci-fi movies and so on. And we were driven out by this kind of nomadic guide who brought his two children with him in the Jeep. And as we're driving these 15 minutes out into the middle of nowhere, we're shouting over the engine. I've sat in the front. Susan is in the back with his two boys, and they're giggling away, and he's talking in whatever language. And eventually he turns to me, he says, FIFA? And he said, he had a little bit of English. He says, they say you sound like man in FIFA. And I went, so I did a little bit of kind of, indeed, and they all were giggling in the background. I am the man from FIFA. So talk about the universal language of football. In Jordan, these two kids, son of some nomadic guide, recognized my voice from FIFA.
The small world that we the weird world that we inhabit.
Indeed.
And it is a weird world, isn't it, gents? This world of commentary. It's very much a, you try and explain it to people, and I don't know. It just seems to be such a unique way to earn money.
It's changed, but as all media has changed, it's been changed by social media, and I don't have an issue with that. I think that I don't have a problem with political correctness as such, because I think it is just showing a sensitivity to other people's feelings, and I think there is a responsibility which goes with picking up a microphone to millions, even if you're only talking about football. But it has certainly changed the landscape of the job. It's a job that everybody thinks they can do. If you meet a heart surgeon, nobody starts to try to give him or her advice on how they should be doing their job. Football commentary is not like that. And whilst we know we are very, very lucky to be among the chosen few who somehow managed to scramble to the surface and grab one of these jobs, beneath us or maybe above us are thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who think, I can do that. Remember the old Boys in the Black stuff? Here's a job, I can do that. Well, that's the job we do. We are a matter of opinion. And I always say that. My opinions of other commentators, I would never share publicly because they were probably the worst judge of each other. But what you're getting through this podcast is that we appreciate that, and we appreciate the other men and women who do our job, the challenges and indeed the luxuries that go with it. And that does provide a communion, I call it this, to say the Coleman Balls communion, that we're all in the same boat together. And so we appreciate each other and like each other.
Just something what Clive said earlier about the team that exists. I think there's a divisive word that television, certainly I come across in BBC television, that they use the word talent in terms of, you know, the summarizers and people such as that. But as Clive had touched upon very early on, without the engineers, without the production staff, we wouldn't be on air. And I think we're all talented in our own different way. And also, when you're on your way up, you meet the same people on your way back down. And I think to try, and that little bit of humility as well, sometimes doesn't go amiss. And Clive was spot on when he referred to the team. It's a team effort.
That's very true. I've been very...
And I'm on the way down, by the way, so yeah.
I've not made it up yet.
we're still trying to navigate the greasy pole. But the point you make is right, Dano. And the times in my career, if I speak for myself, where I've had disappointments, and they're not all football related or sports related, but keeping your opinions to yourself and not burning bridges became very important to me, because the radio, I mean, you guys know television better than I do, and I've never done a television commentary, but the radio industry has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk during my time within it, meaning that if I'd crossed somebody's path by, you know, slagging them off or having an issue with them or taking them on, I would no doubt have bumped into that very same person some years down the line in a different relationship, and I would have paid for my indiscretion from years before. You have to learn to roll with the punches, I guess, going back to Reg Guthridge, and find a way to have a bit of zen about it all and realise that something that goes against you is actually becomes an opportunity rather than...
Yeah, but you've got to be true to yourself, though, Dance, as well. If you've been unfairly or harshly treated, then you don't just accept it. You've still got to stand up for yourself. And I think it's the way that you speak to people. If you speak to them with respect, then you're still able to give your opinion, because you might have been in the right in those situations.
I think that's probably true in one or two instances in my life where at least I did have a private word with somebody, but you don't go on Twitter and send a, you know, a 6-page rant about, you know, calling people all the names under the sun. You just end up, you know, regret at leisure, I suppose.
But yeah, I'm certainly not going to cross you down. Now I've seen that satanic montage which you have behind you. Are you going to be sacrificing some animals later?
Yes.
Is that the final part of this? Yeah.
There's a brindle calf just out of shot. Which is about to be.
I've always been a very huge admirer of you, and even more so now I've seen that damn thing.
For those that aren't aware, he's
paying. Which one's me?
Whichever one you want, the star man. There you go, on the top left. There's a painting of Kiss that's behind me as I'm talking to Denno and Clive. Of the makeup images of the band, and yeah, Starman, yeah. I actually was the Catman in a Kiss tribute band for a few years. Yeah. I had to wear the makeup and the costume and the silly boots.
Yeah. Social services to Mr. Danter's house, please. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, don't worry. Yeah, my probation officer is a regular contributor.
Just don't forget, we were made for loving you, Dance.
Hey. There you go. That's how you round off a podcast. That's the way it should be done. Gentlemen, where are you this weekend? What plans have you got?
I'm at Ibrox. Rangers Television is a regular gig for me. And my timing's been pretty good because Rangers have had a fantastic year. And it's a wonderful experience. So Rangers versus Motherwell.
How about you?
I've got Burnley Arsenal.
Ah, well, you will be seeing my colleague and your old friend Adrian Durham there because... typically what happens is where Five Live are doing a commentary, Talk Sport host their afternoon show from the same ground for the Round the Grounds format. But of course you and Adrian go back.
We do. Yeah, got a long, long time. Good friend of Adrian.
Yeah. Where are you, Ian?
I'm at Anfield, actually, where you guys were last night for Liverpool against Palace. And I'll be interested to see whether Palace can keep up the sort of momentum they seem to have game, both at West Ham in the game I saw a couple of weeks ago, and then especially with the game you saw, Clive, at Selhurst last Saturday, and whether Odson Edouard is given free rein from the start rather than as an impact substitute.
Yeah, I think more importantly is whether the M62, M6 junction is open or not, because it wasn't last night.
Oh, God. I've learnt a long time ago to set off very early for games. I was once late for a game at Bolton when I was working for Tom Ross. There was an accident on the M61. I could see the Reebok Stadium. I was stranded on the M61. I still don't know to this day whether what happened with the accident. Hopefully nobody was badly injured, but whatever. The motorway was shut and I could see the stadium, but obviously couldn't get anywhere near it. And I ended up being 20 minutes late at the start of the game. I was only doing match reports. I wasn't doing a commentary that day and I didn't miss a goal, but Tom rightly tore me off a strip the next day for not being there early enough. And I've never, from that day on, I've always tried to make sure I'm at a ground 3 hours before kickoff. I'm sure you guys are the same.
I have a nightmare about it. I do have a recurring nightmare with hot sweats, but occasionally I do have a bad dream about A, not being prepared for a broadcast, and B, arriving late. And yeah, I think they're quite healthy sort of bad dreams to have.
We once went to Villa with Leeds United, and when we used to get there early, Norman Hunter used to go, I've been here that long, I feel as if I've been on my holidays. But one occasion, the M6 was closed, and we used to present the programme in those days before the commentary, and I arrived at about 7:15, we'd missed the first 15 minutes of the programme, and the head of BBC North pulled me the next day and said, "Very unprofessional, can't believe that you were late." And I actually said to myself, well, actually, it's because I was professional and I left at 2:30 that I was able to do the commentary. Because had I not left to get there for 3 hours before kickoff, you wouldn't have had a commentary at all. And to which he then apologised.
Fair play, Denno. That's a good comeback.
I'm not crossing Denno either. I'm a friend of the pair of you now.
No, absolutely right. Listen, gentlemen, what an absolute delight it's been to have you both with me on the
commentary. Speak for yourself.
All right, well, it's been a delight for me. That's good enough for me. I'll be self-indulgent enough to wave that off. Clive, thank you so much, and all the best with them. Well, I'm sure I'll hear you on Talk Sport in the next couple of weeks when your next assignment comes up with us. It's great.
Thank you, Dance. It's been a delight. Anytime, mate.
It's talking to you. As part of the team. And Denno, I do hope I get to see you somewhere down the line.
Yeah, I'll make a prediction. I'll see Clive before I see you next.
Again, he somehow makes that sound threatening. I don't know how he's done it, but he's made it sound threatening to both Clive and myself. Bad effort that, Denno. Thank you, gentlemen. What an absolute pleasure it's been to be with Ian Dennis from BBC Five Live and Clive Tilsley of Talk Sport and ITV and Rangers TV. And, well, the list goes on. Gentlemen, thank you. That was The Commentator's Curse, Episode 5. There's an archive there of all the previous episodes for you to dip into at your leisure. And I'm sure Episode 6 of The Commentator's Curse is just around the corner. Ian Dancer signing off. Thank you for listening to The Commentator's Curse.